just didn't know how hungry people were to get health insurance that was subsidized for the first time.
Healthcare broker Enroll Alaska rethinks its strategy for the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 13th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the University of Alaska Fairbanks offers to take over the HAARP facility.
President Gamble and Chancellor Rogers volunteered to take ownership, but so far it hasn't. We haven't completed these discussions.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Outside political groups are plugging Alaska's airwaves with ads about Senator Mark Begich. One recent line of attack highlights the scandal at the Veterans Administration, claiming Begich isn't helping veterans. APRN's Liz Ruskin takes a closer look at the claim.
Alleging a senator is indifferent to vets is serious anywhere, even more so in Alaska, which has the highest number of vets per capita. This ad, running on nearly $500,000 of Alaska airtime, aims to plant Begich in the midst of the scandal.
Veterans died waiting for care that never came. Senator Mark Begich sits on the Veterans Affairs Committee. His response? If there's a problem, they need to fix it. If there's a problem?
It's paid for by Crossroads GPS, a national group running ads against Begich, and for Republican challenger Dan Sullivan. Sullivan highlighted the same Begich, if there's a problem, quote, in an op-ed published last month in the Anchorage Daily News. Sullivan says Begich acts like he's a mere bystander to the veteran crisis. But FactCheck.org, a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, says the ad misuses the Begich quote, which is from a Wall Street Journal story. In it, Begich says the administration should have learned its lesson from the healthcare.gov website debacle. The exact Begich quote in the journal is, "They should have learned from that. If there's a problem, they need to fix it." FactCheck says Begich did react to the VA scandal. He called for an immediate hearing, wrote then-VA Secretary Eric Shinseki to express outrage, and at a hearing last month, Begich pressed Shinseki on whether anyone had been fired for falsifying records.
Manipulation of data, of the truth, is serious with me.
Would you fire him?
I will do everything I can within...
That's not the question. I understand...
There is a process here, Senator. Let me not get out ahead of it.
Crossroads unveiled a new TV ad this week, still painting Begich as disengaged on the scandal.
Mark Begich sending a letter is an action.
Senator Begich is ignoring people that can't help him.
Begich is trying to show that he is helping. He's trumpeting Senate passage of a bill this week aimed at getting veterans quicker access to care. In a speech on the Senate floor, Begich says it relies on a solution he's been pressing since he first ran for Senate in 2008, allowing vets to make appointments at non-VA facilities.
When I campaigned on the Heroes Health Card, I just believed that we had this resource that we could maximize, that we could move forward on, that we could make a difference for our veterans. And we're seeing it.
In Alaska, the VA has agreements with Native hospitals and clinics and the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center that have reduced VA wait times to among the lowest in the country. But that brings us to another charge Begich is facing, that he claims credit for successes that weren't his alone. Alaska Congressman Don Young knocked Begich for it in a campaign video that surfaced on YouTube this week.
Don't take credit for something you did not do. And when we do something together, say we did it. I think it'd be a lot better.
The Senate record shows Begich has pressed to have vets seen at Alaska Native Health Centers for years. But it also shows Senator Lisa Murkowski has been pushing that cause since at least 2007, back when Begich was still mayor of Anchorage. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Air Force has paused a plan to demolish the HAARP facility as it reconsiders options for transferring its ionospheric research facility near Gakona to another entity. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that could be the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks would own and operate the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HAARP facility, under a proposal before the Air Force. UAF Geophysical Institute Director Bob McCoy confirms the university has been pursuing the possibility of taking over HAARP.
President Gamble and Chancellor Rogers volunteered to take ownership, but so far it hasn't. We haven't completed these discussions.
McCoy says the offer was initially made during a HAARP summit held in Washington, D.C. at the end of February. HAARP employs large generators to send powerful radio signals through a field of 180 antennas into the ionosphere to stimulate activity like aurora. It's the most powerful of three so-called atmospheric heaters in the world and widely acknowledged as valuable for communications and other research. But the Air Force has decided it no longer needs the facility and closed it last year. It's now slated for demolition this summer unless a new operator is found and alternative funding can be secured. McCoy says HAARP is expensive to operate.
There's maintenance and there's operations, and when it's running, it consumes quite a bit of diesel. So we're trying to figure out ways to share the cost among government agencies so that we can continue to use it.
McCoy likens UAF taking on HAARP to the university's management of the Poker Flat rocket range outside Fairbanks for NASA.
The University of Alaska and the Geophysical Institute, we own it. Scientists from around the country propose to NASA get funding, build rockets, come here, and we help NASA launch them. That's a good model, and we operate it fairly cost-effectively. NASA likes us.
McCoy cites similar partnerships with government agencies under which UAF is funded to operate the Alaska Earthquake Information Center and the Alaska Satellite Facility. UAF scientists have long used HAARP for research.
I'm using HAARP to understand or model the artificial blue aurora and enhanced plasma ionization.
UAF Assistant Professor of Space Engineering Physics Chris Fallon says the loss of HAARP would handicap his research.
Without HAARP, we basically have to wait for nature to create various events in the upper atmosphere that we can then study and try to explain.
Fallon and other scientists have worked at HAARP at the invitation of the Air Force. He says if UAF took it over, scientists could contract out time at the facility. Dozens of researchers from around the world have signed a petition and submitted letters of support for HAARP's continued operation. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Enroll Alaska is scaling back its business in the state. The division of North Rim Bank launched last year with plans to help tens of thousands of Alaskans sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The company ended up with disappointing results and is now rethinking its strategy. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Until October 1st came around last year, Enroll Alaska was thinking big. The company launched an advertising campaign. It made plans to open kiosks around the state, and it was ready with an army of agents who could enroll 6,000 Alaskans each month in new subsidized health insurance plans. Joshua Weinstein is a consultant with North Rim Benefits Group who helped launch Enroll Alaska.
We just didn't know how hungry people were to get health insurance that was subsidized for the first time.
As it turned out, not very hungry. Enroll Alaska's goal was to sign up 40,000 people during the open enrollment period. Instead, their final count was 2,400. Weinstein attributes the disappointing figure partly to the bungled rollout of healthcare.gov. The website essentially didn't function for the first 2 months. And he says several other factors played a role.
There's a lot of opposition to the Affordable Care Act. There still is. A lot of confusion about how the tax credits and subsidies work. The insurance companies weren't smoothly processing the application. So there was a lot more service than anyone anticipated.
In October, Enroll Alaska had 30 agents working for the division. Now, North Rim Benefits Group has restructured, keeping just 6 agents based in Anchorage who will work on both group and individual policies. Weinstein says the company also decided not to renew the contract of COO Tyann Bowling, who was instrumental in starting Enroll Alaska.
We did not achieve our enrollment expectations, which accordingly we've adjusted our staffing to support the business that we did capture.
Weinstein says he's very comfortable with the position Enroll Alaska is in now, and he anticipates hiring new agents to meet demand during the next open enrollment period from November 15th to February 15th. He says the company thinks it can double the number of its enrollees in Alaska for next year.
The penalties are becoming more substantial for people in 2015 who don't have health coverage. So what was once 1% or $95 is doubling or more for people who don't buy insurance. That might encourage people to look at this again.
Since the 2014 open enrollment period closed in mid-April, Weinstein says Enroll Alaska has signed up more new clients than anticipated, about 50 to 75 people each month who have what are considered qualifying life events, like changing jobs or moving. Overall, about 13,000 Alaskans signed up for health insurance on healthcare.gov during the open enrollment period. Weinstein says the federal government estimates more than 100,000 Alaskans qualify for subsidies to buy health insurance. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, fisheries managers see positive signs for kings on the Kenai.
The Kenai River early run is promising, especially compared to last year. I mean, it's not a robust, large run by any means.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at Alaska.bp.com.
As the Bering Sea's largest fishery opened this week, pollock fishermen were looking forward to a strong season, but they were also under fire from rural users who believe industry's catching too many salmon. Many vessels will be using excluder nets to let salmon escape, and they'll all participate in the rolling hotspot closure program, avoiding areas where other trawlers have run into high concentrations of salmon, but that's not enough to relieve the tension between commercial and subsistence use. It came to a head last week when the North Pacific Fishery Management Council met in Nome. The council heard hours of testimony from Western Alaskans. Many of them are facing extreme restrictions on fishing this summer because of poor salmon returns, and many were upset that commercial fishermen haven't been asked to cut back on bycatch in the same way. At yesterday's Upete Nation Fish Forum in Bethel, long-term planning for tribal fishery co-management took a back seat to the anxiety and uncertainty surrounding the current king salmon restrictions. KUYK's Ben Matheson has more.
At a time of year when they would normally be at fish camp filling their racks with king salmon, a few dozen fishermen sat in a windowless former bowling alley talking about restrictions. Philip Peter is from Akyachuk.
Those elders used to tell us not to idle, sitting around in our village in summer when fish are coming in. I tell you the truth. Hunger has no law.
Tim Andrew is Natural Resources Director for the Association of Village Council Presidents. He says people are seeing high numbers from the Bethel test fishery, but aren't hearing from managers on how the run is building.
People have got to know. If they don't know, they look at their fish rack, they look at the needs of the family, they're going to say the hell with it. We're going to go out and fish. We need to feed our family.
The prospect of famine came up frequently, and local managers were grilled by participants, including Ed Johnstone with the Quinault Indian Nation and Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. Speaking before a panel that included state manager Aaron Potter, Johnstone compared the situation on the Kuskokwim to a massacre.
I got a whole list on the internet of massacres of Indian people over time. This has the makings of being a massacre.
I gotta say, that's pretty out of line.
No,
that's absolutely not the intent of what anybody here is doing.
I'm getting to the severity of the question. If you're not hearing these people, you're doing an injustice.
At times, the testimony even referred to the possibility of violence. One woman was afraid her son and some young men would go fishing with guns in the boat. After countless stories of subsistence fishermen growing restless as the closure nears 4 weeks, there was some reason for optimism. Brian McCaffrey says the restrictions appear to be letting many fish swim past Bethel and that could mean more harvest for locals through a special cultural and social permit.
The preliminary numbers are looking positive. It's still too early to know if that run is going to continue or if it'll drop off quickly like it does in some years. But at this point, what I can say is that I'm entertaining the possibility of sometime early next week of possibly bumping that up.
McCaffrey says the species mix is including more and more chum and sockeye. A state-run dipnet fishery could begin next week, and McCaffrey says even a 6-inch gillnet opening for chum and sockeye may be possible late next week for the lower river. Still, in a year of unprecedented closures, managers are having a tough time determining exactly what the Bethel test fishery numbers mean. Research biologist Kevin Schaberg says although fish are moving past Bethel, they've never had a complete closure before, and that makes it hard to come to any conclusions at the moment.
We're not able to actually track what the run timing is quite as well this year, so we need to be a little bit cautious on how we interpret that 225 today and what do we think that means at the end of the season.
As Thursday's meeting drew to a close, ACIAC's Ivan M. Ivan summed up the sentiments of many in the room.
Consider your mathematics. I don't quite understand the mathematics that were discussed, but please allow us to fish.
In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued an emergency order restricting personal use set netting on the Kosilof River yesterday, but managers are seeing some promising signs for king runs on the Kenai, Susitna, and Deshka rivers. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports.
Fish and Game put a very similar restriction in place last summer. The difference is how they cut fishing time approximately in half. Last year, they closed the fishery halfway through its 10-day season, and this year, personal use set netters will get the full season, but fishing hours per day will be cut. It'll be open from 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. beginning June 15th. Usually, it's open until 11 p.m. ADF&G Commercial Fisheries Area Management Biologist Pat Shields says there's not an exact correlation between decreasing fishing time and decreasing the harvest of early-run Kosilof kings, but it's close.
No, I don't have some table, some graph, some, you know, analysis that will indicate that, you know, we're going to save 43.1% of the fish by taking away 43.1% of the hours. But that's what we would assume. Take away half the hours, we would hope that we would save half of the harvest of the kings.
Kenai River-bound king salmon do get most of the attention, but both the early and late run on the Kosilof River have their own struggles. The early run has missed its escapement goals in two of the last 5 years, even when the department put heavy sport fishing restrictions in place. Now, as we recall, the fishing for the early king run on the Kenai was shut down completely this year. Pretty drastic move. And sport fishing on the Kosilof, taking all those restrictions together, is all but closed. But there's some good news.
To date right now, the Kenai River early run is promising, especially compared to last year. I mean, it's not a robust large run by any means, but we already have made the forecast for the return this year, and we're only between a third and a halfway through the run, depending on run timing. And so that's encouraging that the early run to date, anyway, is returning at a rate better than we expected.
He says the Susitna River is seeing a better than expected run of kings too, and so is the Deshka.
At this point, though, it's good to be talking about a glass that might be half full rather than saying for sure the glass is half empty. And we haven't been able to talk positively about kings for a few years. I'm not trying to say that we're there yet because we are early in these runs, but at least the early part of the king salmon returns in quite a few systems this year look promising.
Of course, no numbers are out yet for the Kosilof, but the early king run on the Kenai has already surpassed last year's run with 3 weeks left. As of Monday, more than 2,200 kings had been counted. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Gold Miner. Gold is in Clutch Lounsbury's blood. His grandparents took the Valdez Trail up to Fairbanks during the gold rush, and Clutch was on a cat before he could walk. He's searched in creeks, canyons, and underground. He's sluice-boxed, dredged, and hard rock mined all over the interior and the Arctic. Today, he lives in Esther above an 800-foot mine shaft in the hillside. Molly Reddick talked to Clutch for this series on life in Fairbanks before the pipeline boom.
So we got two good lights. I think we'll be good. We'll get a hard hat. And then
go find some gold.
Go find some gold.
Clutch Lounsbury's mine on Esther Dome begins from the Arctic entryway of his old cabin and stabs 800 feet into the hillside. The narrow tunnel, called a drift, feels like a secret underground passageway. His dad built it in the 1930s, following a gold vein as it zigzagged through the hill.
First 60 foot was, my dad didn't have a compressor. He used a chisel and a hammer and dynamite. And that's how he got in here.
Clutch has a white bushy beard and has often been mistaken for Santa Claus.
Kind of walk the track here so you don't get your shoes too wet.
In his mine, it's dark, damp, and 35 degrees year-round. Clutch and his brother George mined it until 1980, drilling 100-foot core samples into the walls every few feet, searching for gold.
And there's the vein. You see that white, milky quartz? That's all there is. It's about 2 inch wide. That's what you're looking for when you're mining.
The Lounsburys have deep roots in Alaska. Clutch's great-grandfather built the first church in Fairbanks in 1905. Shortly after, his grandfather followed his grandmother up north.
I thought he'd come near looking for gold, but actually he was looking for his girlfriend that he went to school with in Oregon.
They took a horse and sleigh up the Valdez Trail to Fairbanks and mined on Engineer Creek and Fox. When E.T. Barnett, the founder of Fairbanks, swindled the bank in 1911, his grandparents lost a lot of money and headed back to Iowa. Clutch's dad was 3. As soon as he turned 18, he hitchhiked back to Alaska with $50 in his pocket.
Just like a Sam would be going back to spawn, you know?
His mom grew up in Fairbanks in the apartment above the railroad depot. An old picture shows her playing in the backyard with her pet black bear cub. Clutch was born in 1945 and was moving dirt with his dad by age 2. He mined for coal and helium and built roads for the state for 20 years, mostly in the Brooks Range. But he never stopped looking for gold. In 1984, he was passing through Boundary on the Canadian border on his way to check out a mine in Dawson. There was a beautiful cook named Lorna working at Action Jack's Bar and Restaurant.
When I first met Lorna, she had 3 horses, 3 sons, 3 violins, 3 banjos, and it was the other 2 guys I was worried about.
Lorna wrangled wild mustangs in Reno before moving to Alaska for work.
I was a cowboy all winter one time. My job was to go to the top of the hill and start the mares and the colts down towards the ropers, and I'd go up there and look down on Highway 40 and
the Mustang Ranch.
Mustang Ranch.
In the 70s, Clutch and his brother inherited claims from their friend in Wiseman, a tiny mining town in the Brooks Range that was only connected to the Hall Road in the 90s. The first big nugget in the region came out of their creek in 1916.
It was worth $669.50, and it was 35 ounces and 5 penny weight.
Prospectors were already building a city in Coldfoot. When they heard about the nugget, they moved their equipment and cabins 10 miles upriver.
The stampede started that way. The next year, they found a nugget twice that size, just 3 miles up the road from my place on the Hammond. They found a 60-ouncer, and eventually, I think it was 150-ouncer or something. There was just huge nuggets all around that area were discovered in the last couple decades or so.
The biggest one Clutch ever found is the size of his fingernail, but that's not why he does it.
I never really cared about getting rich. It was an adventure.
Clutch and Lorna run the Wiseman Gold Camp B&B every summer. Lorna rides her 2 horses, and Clutch works on the local mining museum and prospects up the canyon.
Now you never know, I might run into something. I haven't lost hope yet. It's a lot of dirt between that gold.
And just like that, he's off to start looking again. In Fairbanks, I'm Molly Reddig.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Girdwood, which was originally founded as a camp for placer gold miners. Kirsty Ryan describes her hometown.
It's a great town. It's really small, but it's a cute little town that you can grow up in. I grew up in Girdwood for 8 years. It's really nice because it's in the forest. and there's a bunch of animal life and wildlife that you can see, like moose and bears and stuff that are literally right in your community. There's also a bunch of little shops that you can go see, especially for tourists, like jade shops and gold shops, little trinkets and everything like that that the community may have made. There is only one school in Girdwood, holding about, I want to say, like 300 or 400 kids in all, and it consists of kindergarten through eighth grade. There is no middle school and there is no high school. It's also really nice because it's right next to a world-renowned resort. It gets really convenient to be able to go skiing and snowboarding, and a lot of tourists come there, so you're able to see new people and make new friends. Then there's the Forest Fair, which is a great little thing that Girdwood puts together at the beginning of July for about 3 days to bring tourists to come to Girdwood and experience what it's like.
Kirsty Ryan lives in Girdwood. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Molly Reddig, Sean Carpenter, and Annie Feit. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Shaylin Cochran in Kenai. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.